He opened and closed each of the four drawers in quick succession before returning to the desk empty-handed.
I'd rather not do this on the computer, he said, hovering his fingers above the keyboard. But I can't put my hands on the hard copies right now.
Okay, the doctor continued. So let's think this through. You need to know about the examinations that were undertaken when Amy was first found, yes? Alex felt her pulse quicken. Yes, I suppose so, if that's okay.
Well, Peter Haynes began. It's a rather grey area. Amy has no known next of kin, so she's under the care of the health authority.
He paused, catching up with his thoughts.
And that means we can take decisions, but we can't be seen to abuse that authority.
He looked up and fixed his eyes on Alex's lips.
I would never abuse any position of trust, he said.
Alex sat in silence, unsure what she was supposed to say. Meanwhile, the doctor tapped cautiously at the keyboard, like he was cracking a safe. He cleared his throat.
I shouldn't give this information out liberally, so anything I say needs to be handled with absolute discretion.
He paused and Alex held her breath. The doctor was frozen, fingers over the keys. His eyes were locked on Alex in a way that made her wiggle awkwardly in her seat.
Okay.
He lowered his gaze, half smiling.
I'm doing this for you because I think the more people know about these patient stories, the better. But that relies on you doing a sensitive job, so I'm taking a leap of faith.
I promise I'm not out to sensationalize. That's not the kind of writing I do. Peter Haynes's neck was newly flushed, and he seemed unsure where to start.
Okay.
Alex scanned her notes. Was Amy a virgin?
No.
Oh, really? Had she recently had sex before she was found?
Yes, she had, sometime within the previous 72 hours, according to this report.
The secret information thrilled Alex. It was at once revolting and exhilarating. Okay, so were there signs of sexual assault?
There were no signs of trauma to the genitals.
So she'd willingly had sex?
It would appear so.
Were there signs she had fought off her attacker?
Oh God, yes.
Peter Haynes looked Alex in the eye, furrowing his brow slightly.
I don't need to look at the records to tell you that. She was still black and blue when she reached me, and I can remember what a state her fingers were in. Most of her nails were broken off, and she had a missing tooth where she had tried to bite something. Or someone.
Alex felt the exhilaration subside. Now she just felt sick. Amy had managed to fight just enough to condemn herself to purgatory. And there were signs of strangulation?
Yes, strangulation, deep bruising, some internal injuries to the abdomen, splintered bones, several cracked ribs.
Was she beaten with something, or did the examiner think he'd done it with his bare hands?
It doesn't go into that here, but from what I saw, I'd say she'd taken everything he had. Kicks, punches, whacks with objects. Who knows?
Christ. So Amy was as close to death as the papers made out when she was found?
Probably worse. There's a lot of information on her record that was marked as confidential and wouldn't have been in the papers.
These details would have been gold dust to a prosecutor, thought Alex, and they wouldn't have given them away in case that jeopardized a trial. It felt like just another quiet injustice that Amy never got her trial. Do you think her attacker thought he'd killed her when he left the scene?
Who knows?
The doctor held her gaze.
I mean, really, who knows what a person like that thinks?
Alex nodded. The uncomfortable facts were seeping through her notes like a dark ink blot. It appeared that Amy had willingly had sex with someone and been attacked soon after. She was there, in part, through trust and choice. So she wasn't raped or sexually assaulted. It was a non-sexual attack, Alex clarified.
That's what it looks like on paper here, but there would be far more details in the police forensic reports. I'm just looking at the bare medical facts, just the stuff we needed to know to treat her.
Could the person she had sex with and the person who attacked her be two different people?
Yes, possibly, Dr. Haynes said, looking at his watch. It's possible that she willingly had sex with someone, then toddled off and ran into someone else who attacked her, but no one ever came forward who'd had consensual sex with her, Alex finished. Right?
Right. Alex continued. So she had a boyfriend, but apparently they hadn't slept together, so...
I can't really help there. I wouldn't have the first clue about my patients' love lives. I can barely get my own on track.
Peter Haynes looked up briefly, and then back down at his hands. Oh yes, of course, Alex said, feeling her cheeks flush a little. Just one more thing. Last time we spoke, you said Amy had shown signs of brain activity. Does that mean there's a chance she might wake up?
Well, she's not asleep, Alex. That's an important distinction. This isn't a coma. She's in there somewhere, to a small degree at least. But after 15 years, and with such slow progress, I think it's highly unlikely she'll ever improve.
But it's possible?
Well, it's not entirely impossible, but it's highly unlikely. Alex, I'm sorry to rush you, but I really need to get to another meeting.
No problem at all, and thanks so much. You've really helped iron things out. It's been hard to piece together from news clippings alone. Alex stood up quickly and grabbed her bag.
Well, said Dr. Haynes, extending a hand to shake. You can't trust everything you read in the newspapers.
And he smiled, holding Alex's hand for a little too long. The chill of Dr. Haynes's touch stayed with Alex long after she'd left the office and made her way, blinking, out of the hospital and into the sunlight. She walked with sore feet to her car, which was parked in the furthest corner, shaded by a thick tree. She sat down with a heavy humph and placed her bag, notepad, and phone on the empty passenger seat. She yanked off her shoes and lobbed them into the back footwell. For just a few moments, she closed her eyes in the cool quiet. Her head thumped, and she was sweating last night's Sauvignon Blanc. Her conversation with the doctor had stitched together some assumptions and scorched some guesses where they lay. As grotesque as she found the crime, the challenge of unpicking Amy's final conscious moments stirred a small part of her, buried beneath the rubble. Once upon a time she had been a bright young thing, a celebrated writer, a voice of her generation. She'd had fire and ambition and ideas. Now, most of the time, she felt dry. Her moment had passed, and she'd spent it wasted. Alex slipped her flip-flops on and headed home. Her mind churned over her conversation with the doctor as she drove slowly past the white villas of Tunbridge Wells' moneyed village area. Amy Stevenson was not a virgin. Apparently, she'd willingly had sex in the run-up to her attack, and it must have been protected sex. According to the clippings, there was no forensic evidence, no semen, that word only used in biology class and sex crime reporting. They, must have used a condom, but that would have been long lost or long hidden. Police had been satisfied that Amy and her boyfriend hadn't slept together, so it looked like Amy had been unfaithful to him. Poor kid, thought Alex. Did he know one of her last decisions was to betray him? Would he have known that her rape wasn't rape? Or perhaps he did find out and was so angry that he attacked her. It seemed far-fetched, but it was foolish to discount anything. It had become a standard phrase in the later newspaper clippings, the rape and attempted murder of Amy Stevenson. But that wasn't the real story. The police couldn't have known that when they brought Bob in, could they? Alex shook her head. It was a far knottier story than she'd thought. The best articles she could produce would be found in the kinks left behind from unpicking those dusty knots. She wished she could skip to the end and find out what those kinks looked like. She pulled up outside her brick terrace, heaved her bag out of its seat and walked along the path. Alex checked the time. 11:22 a.m. The deadline for her piece on Dr. Haynes loomed in a few days, and she had 38 minutes of work time left today. Getting to sleep wasn't a problem for Alex. Her eyes tended to shut as the final sip tingled her lips. It was often a battle of will over fatigue just to get the glass of water down her neck before passing out in a deep, throaty sleep. It was staying asleep that was hard. Since Matt had left, the witching hours were wakeful. As the tide of alcohol washed away, a heightened sense of self-preservation kicked in. Every night brought different creaks and groans to the little house, a variety of imagined terrors creeping in the shadows. Alex's night nerves were almost as irrational as her childhood fear of ghosts. It was always possible that someone could break in. If they did, it was possible they'd get up to something really sadistic, rather than look for easily pocketed high-value goods. But it was incredibly unlikely. By day, Alex recognized her paranoia for what it was. By night, she often spent the darkest hours rigid and dripping with sweat. After a late supper of toast dipped into a half-eaten tub of hummus, she'd fallen into a hot, dreamless sleep at around 10 p.m., chickpea residue on her hands. At 1:37 a.m., Alex burst into total wakefulness, on high alert, convinced that someone was in the house. Downstairs, the polished floorboards creaked in rhythm with the wind, and the trees tapped warnings on the windows. She heard slow, deliberate movements around her living room. She heard the first three steps of the staircase sigh underfoot, then nothing. Alex remained paralyzed, making no moves to investigate or protect herself. She just lay prone, peeping from under the covers, coated in thick sweat. A few more noises echoed through the house. A little way up the street, a car door slammed. A cat shrieked as gears crunched and tires drove away. 2 hours passed, with Alex dry-eyed and sweating. Finally, having braved a trip to the bathroom and finding no harm on the way, she was able to fall back into a just-below-the-surface slumber. The morning found Alex red-eyed and agitated. Since her mid-twenties, she'd lost the ability to lie in and felt a strong pull to the thick black coffee her kitchen offered. Her bed was dry, but the bedding still smelled bittersweet. Out of habit, Alex stripped it all off and padded downstairs. As she set the coffee machine off with a sigh, something caught her eye. Her moleskin notepad was closed. She was sure she'd left it open on the first blank page, weighted by her pen. Now it was tightly shut. The sudden sound of blood in her temples drowned out clear thought as Alex thundered back up the stairs and into the bathroom, locking the door as quickly as her shaking fingers could manage. Was she imagining it? It had been a heavy night. Could she have returned to her notes before bed, thumbing through and then closing the notepad tight? It was all possible, but it didn't feel right. Alex stepped into the scorching shower. Nothing added up, but she was an unreliable witness. Supper was a blur, and she definitely didn't remember coming to bed. She couldn't be sure of anything. Fuck. As the thick steam and the sharp citrus zing of the shampoo cleared her sinuses, Alex's heart rate slowed, and she became more sure that she must have been the nightcrawler. Thinking logically, there really was nothing else to suggest anything undue had happened. The pen could even have rolled out and the notepad snapped closed all by itself. Leaving her hair wet in the Indian summer heat, Alex threw on knickers, sweatpants, and a vest. Back in the kitchen, the coffee was ready, the rich chicory fragrance turning Alex's delicate stomach almost as much as it comforted her. She needed food, and had started to make toast when something else caught her eye and made her stop dead butter knife in hand. When Alex had inherited the house, she had remodeled the kitchen and the bathroom. She'd stripped the floors herself, painted every inch of wall, and replaced the front door. She'd had enough money left to replace the windows at the front of the house and keep a little cash in the kitty. The back windows were the old sash variety, thick wood with a brass hook and catch. No one could see them from the street, so she'd left them as they were, with some vague plan to update them eventually. She never opened her kitchen window. Never. But her kitchen window was open. It was definitely open. The little garden at the back of Alex's house had been untouched for years. It was really just a yard, with a few dead sprigs of once-were plants and a lopsided whirligig dripping with cobwebs. Still reeling at the window, Alex jumped as the toast popped up, spinning around instinctively. There was no denying it. The window was definitely open. She fumbled in the stuff drawer by the sink for the back door key. The lock was stiff, but once outside she could see that the back gate was shut at least, and the catch was down. She tiptoed closer, her eyes focused on the bolt. With the laughter of neighbors' children in the near distance, Alex inched forward. The bolt had clearly been pulled back, a spider's home broken in the process. But when? She didn't dare open the gate, but instead yanked the bolt back across and ran straight into her kitchen. She slammed the door, locked it, and reached for the cordless phone, unsure who to call. It didn't look like anything had been taken. Her laptop was on the sofa, her TV was where it always was, and she had precious little jewelry anyway. She ran upstairs to check it, but everything was present and correct. Even her engagement and wedding rings lay where they had long lived, in the mirrored box on her nightstand. She had to get her head together. It was a long time since she'd felt so vulnerable and violated, but nothing had been taken, and she'd not been touched, as far as she remembered. As she scrabbled for the back page of her moleskin and that number in thick black writing, she knew she was making a mistake. Alex dialed with shaking hands and walked into the kitchen to pour another strong black coffee. She lifted the mug to her lips just as Matt answered.
Hello?
Hi, Matt, it's Alex.
I know, your number came up on my screen again. What's up?
Matt, I'm so sorry, I didn't know who else to call. She started, her wobbly voice barely more than a whine.
Oh, God, Alex,
Matt hissed.
It's 8 in the morning. What's wrong with you?
No, I've not been drinking. Look, I don't know what to do. I think someone's broken into my house. She heard a sigh.
Alex, if you think someone's broken into your house, then you need to call the police. Your local police. They'll send someone round.
No, Matt, you don't understand. Nothing's been taken. I know they won't believe me because nothing's been stolen, but the kitchen window was open and the bolt on the back gate has been moved.
Nothing's been taken?
Well, no, but I'd left my notepad open last night and it was closed this morning. She trailed off.
Alex, no one has broken into your house. What you're saying is your back gate's unlocked, just like most of your neighbors' back gates are probably unlocked, and your kitchen window isn't closed. It's still warm at night. You probably opened the window yourself and forgot.
Alex was as certain as she could be that she'd not opened her own window. She'd never opened that window to prevent this precise scenario. She was petrified about forgetting and going to bed with the outside able to get in.
The police won't be interested unless you've had something stolen, or there's actual evidence that someone's been in.
Matt's measured tone only loosely disguised his annoyance. It was breakfast time at the weekend. He'd probably had to leave his fiancée and step outside of the room. She'd put him in a difficult spot.
I'm sorry, Matt. I thought you'd understand, but... Alex, enough. We're not married anymore, and I thought you'd finally got to grips with that. I'm not the one you call now. I was very understanding when you asked me to help with this wild goose chase. I've helped you more than I should have because I felt sorry for you, And if I'm honest, I knew that nothing would ever come of it. But why not? Why would nothing come of it?
Alex squeaked down the phone.
Why? Because you haven't seen anything through in years, Alex. Look at yourself.
Matt, there's no need to be cruel. I just didn't...
Alex, he hissed. I thought we'd stopped all this. I hoped you'd sorted yourself out.
A pause. A breath.
You drank away your career. You drank away our marriage. You drank away... You know what you drank away. And now it looks like you've drunk away your fucking sanity. Do yourself a favor and get some help before it's too late. You have to move on, like I have.
Like you have, Alex repeated. She'd just started to apologize as the phone clicked. He'd gone. Again. Alex tore out the page with his number on, screwed it into a ball and ran it under a blast of cold water until it stuck together in a clump. She threw it into the bin with the cold toast, too embarrassed to acknowledge to herself what had just happened, ignoring the chill creeping up her chest.
Chapter 18. Jacob. 15th of September, 2010. Jacob knew from the flash in Fiona's eyes that he was in deep trouble. Not just forgetting to put the bins out trouble, but something genuine, at least to her. He remembered the first time he'd seen that flash. They'd been together for nearly 6 months, no longer dating, just always with one another. Her toothbrush was in his bathroom and her underwear was in his laundry basket. She hadn't moved in officially, but she had one foot in the door and he liked the way that felt. Until that point, his visits to the hospital had been sporadic, maybe once every couple of months, but the tighter he felt bound to Fiona, the stronger he felt a sense of duty to Amy. He'd arranged to go to work late one day so he could have a lie-in and then visit the ward for a little longer. He wanted to tell Amy that he had found someone and that he was sorry, just in case she was in there somewhere, waiting for him. He wasn't going to drop her like everyone else had, but he was going to level with her. Jacob had waited until long after Fiona had left for the print shop, snoozing his alarm and sleeping fitfully. He'd spent the rest of the morning in the ward, sitting with Amy and trying to build up the courage to tell her he had moved on in a way she couldn't. He'd stared at her face. She was still wired up back then, and her body frequently rejected its drip, convulsing with an automatic determination at odds with her passive condition. As a result, Amy had been incredibly thin. Her beauty hidden behind razor blade cheekbones and dark dips under her eyes. He'd held her hand in lieu of her gaze, then bottled out. Rather than tell her he was moving on, Jacob had committed to coming back to visit sooner next time, imagining a glimmer of eye movement as he whispered his promises. When he'd been back at work for a couple of hours, Jacob had realized that he'd forgotten to switch his phone back on. As soon as it sprang to life, he found several texts and voicemails. He'd called Fiona straight back, but got no response. That night, he saw the flash in her dark eyes for the first time. "Where were you today?" she'd asked. "I was at work. Why?"
"I called and you weren't there."
"When? This morning?"
"Yeah."
Jacob paused for just a split second. The truth, as it stood, was half told and did no one any favors.
"I was visiting a client. You said you had loads of paperwork to catch up on."
"I did. I still do. But I had to go out to Sussex at the last minute."
"Why?"
The fire in her eyes had cooled.
"Shit. I'm sorry. I'm acting like a crazy person."
That time, they'd laughed about it. When it happened again a few months later, again due to a clandestine hospital visit and a number of missed calls, the fire had taken longer to put out. They'd channeled it into bed, not knowing what else to do with the friction.
"I'm sorry, Jay,"
Fiona had said afterwards, lying in the nook of his arm and staring up at the ceiling. Her hair had been stuck to her forehead and clothes lay strewn on the floor.
"Dan was such a fuckwit for this kind of thing. I felt like such a mug when I found out he'd been cheating on me. And it wasn't just once or twice. I can't handle the thought of that happening again. That's not fair on you, though. I know you're not him."
"I'm sorry I worried you."
"Don't apologize to me. I'm being an idiot. It's a stupid trap that everyone falls into, isn't it? Bringing old relationships into new ones."
He hadn't said a word.
"Except you," she'd teased. "Look at me, taming a stud."
"Oh, Fiona," he'd laughed. "You know those girls you think were just flings probably didn't see you that way. You probably broke their hearts."
Fiona's eyes twinkled mischievously.
"Oh, God, stop. Actually, carry on. No, I mean, stop," he'd smiled.
"You really didn't have any proper girlfriends at uni or college?"
"No, not really. Just the odd thing that fizzled out."
"So, I'm your first proper girlfriend, really?"
"Yes. For the 50 millionth time, you're my first proper girlfriend since school," he'd said. "School doesn't count. That's a fact. So, I'm your first proper girlfriend. La la la, look at me," she'd sung. "Your first proper girlfriend. The one you ditched your womanizing ways for."
He'd pulled her into him and kissed her, laughing.
"You're so silly."
Other times she would ask him about his university affairs, only to stop him the moment he started to cobble a description together.
"Naturally, don't tell me anything. I don't like thinking of you with other girls."
"You're my number one girl," he'd say, and kiss her with relief.
Jacob hated to see that flash in her eyes, and he'd seen it more and more in pregnancy. He was meticulous about doctor's appointments, midwife checkups, antenatal classes, ultrasounds, and everything else marked in thick pen on the kitchen calendar. He'd never missed a single meeting with his future son or daughter. It wasn't their wedding anniversary, her birthday, or any other important date. Everything had been fine when she'd kissed him goodnight and gone to bed. But this morning, Fiona wouldn't even meet his gaze.
"Do you have any plans today?" he asked, trying to sound light.
"Nope."
"Are you doing anything at lunchtime? Meeting any friends?"
"No."
"How do you fancy having a nice lunch somewhere then? Maybe we could drive down to Rye?"
"Why?"
"No, Rye," he'd smiled, trying to crack her mood. But she had just glared harder.
"Okay, because you're my wife, and I love you, and we don't have much time left for long lunches on our own."
"Okay, Fee, I give up. What's wrong?"
Ha! The snort-come laugh sent a chill through him. Ordinarily, she was spilling words when she had a problem.
"What is it? You're worrying me now."
"I'm worrying you, am I? I'm worrying you. That's rich, Jacob. That's fucking rich."
"I have no idea what I've done, so why don't you just tell me?"
Fiona sat down heavily, sinking into the oatmeal armchair, gesturing to her belly, her eyes filled with tears.
"I'm 35 weeks pregnant, Jacob. 35 weeks pregnant with your child, and I have to pee a lot."
And with that, the tears came in gulping, fat sobs. Jacob knelt by his wife and gently placed one hand on her shoulder and one hand on the enormous bump.
"There's no need to be upset. I know your body's changing, and that must be weird for you. It's weird for me, too, but..."
Fiona brushed his hand from her stomach, lifting a face black with yesterday's mascara.
"Jacob, you really are stupid sometimes. I'm 35 weeks pregnant, and I have to pee all day and all bloody night.
She sniffed, wiping her nose on her sleeve as she staggered to her feet. He reeled back from kneeling, steadying himself with a hand.
I had to get up and pee in the early hours last night, and you weren't in our bed. I checked downstairs in case you'd fallen asleep on the sofa, but you weren't there. I checked the whole fucking house, Jay, and then I checked your car, and it was gone.
She drew a quick breath, hands on hips.
Where the fuck were you?
I didn't know you'd woken up.
Where the fuck were you?
I was just driving around.
You're lying to me.
I'm not lying to you.
You're lying! You think you could just lie to me now and it doesn't matter anymore.
That's not true. I just drove around for a bit. I wanted to clear my head. I was feeling stressed about stuff, about work, about the baby. I just wanted to get out for a bit.
At 1:30 in the morning?
Yes, at 1:30 in the morning. I thought you were fast asleep. I didn't mean to worry you.
So where did you go then?
I just drove around.
Where did you drive around?
I don't know, really, just around town.
So you stayed in Tunbridge Wells? You only drove around Tunbridge Wells?
Yes, mostly.
Mostly?
Yes, totally then. I just drove around Tunbridge Wells.
Did you stop anywhere?
Did I stop anywhere?
Stop repeating what I'm saying and answer the flaming question. Did you stop anywhere?
No, I didn't stop anywhere.
You didn't pick up any petrol? Or maybe a snack? Or maybe another fucking woman?
Fiona's body sagged, but her eyes were ablaze.
Oh, for God's sake, Fiona, I just drove around. I give you the benefit of the doubt so much, Jacob, but you've just rammed it in my face this time.
Jesus Christ, this is so unnecessary. You don't give me the benefit of the doubt. You interrogate me like you're doing now. I'd never have gone for a drive if I'd realised the trouble it would cause. I just really needed to get out.
Do you know what, Jacob? Fucking snap, that's what. I just need to get out.
With a sputter of energy and still wearing her maternity pyjamas and slipper boots, Fiona stormed out of the house, snatching her car keys off the hall table as she went. And with a door slam and a shriek of revs, she was gone. Jacob had nowhere to go and nothing to do. He sat on the stairs and stared at the front door. Who was there that he could call, really? University friends he'd spent the 3 years of his degree avoiding? Mark from work? Barely above an acquaintance. Jacob thought of his younger brother, Tom, so far away. Who did he call? He'd been popular as a kid. There were usually one or two friends back to play from primary school. Tom usually had a little cluster around him during break times at the grammar. But Jacob didn't see him for his last years of school and didn't remember anyone coming to call. All he remembered was the dyed hair and the dark music and a permanently shut bedroom door. The last time Jacob had seen Tom was the wedding, where he'd been painfully quiet, blending into the background and hovering around their mother. Did that same shy man have a ferocious social life that kept him from thoughts of home? Was it really just about work? And his other brother, Simon, what did he do in his downtime? With a threesome of boys, it was probably to their parents' credit that no one was piggy in the middle. Simon, the spit of his father in so many ways, had also shared his interests and demeanor. They would pair off, playing tennis, running errands, or sitting quietly, frowning slightly as they read or watched television. And that left Tom and Jacob to bob around together, comfortably jostling and playing. They were pals, both young for their years, making dens, wrestling, and building Lego constructions far longer than was normal. Until Amy came on the scene. Then Jacob would close his door quietly but resolutely if she was over to see him, leaving Tom to his Game Boy and the sound of Lego tipping onto the floor. And then afterwards, What did Tom do after Amy's attack, when Jacob retreated even more? Was Tom taken under his father's wing while Jacob lay alone on his bed, staring into space for those long months? It was a blur, and one he didn't really want to explore. Taking his keys from the hall table, Jacob slammed the door on the silent house and opted instead for the loud music and growling engine of his car. With nowhere specific to go, he went where he increasingly headed in spare moments, to the snug red brick terraces of Axminster Road.
Chapter 19. Alex. 15th of September 2010. Alex pushed the trolley along each Sainsbury's aisle in turn, although her list was short. She lingered amongst the vegetables, hesitating between two organic cucumbers for over 5 minutes. Eventually, with a little food in the corners of the trolley and a fresh pack of dry nights pads, she wheeled her way down the wine aisle, trying to quell the acceleration. She hovered by the rosé. Should I? For a change? Then immediately reversed back to the same white section she'd plundered for the last few weeks. As Alex loaded the bags into the boot of her car, arms aching, the sound of her phone's ringtone burst out of her bag. This was rare enough to make her jump, and she answered suspiciously.
Hi, Alex. It's Andy Bellamy from The Times. Can we arrange a time for you to come in?
Alex's knees clattered together as she shivered on the narrow, whopping pavement, craning her neck to look up beyond the tall, grey walls. She breathed deeply, the cold air wrapping itself around her lungs as Alex drank in the huge tower. It was still the colour of wet newspaper, rising up out of the East London mess. News International's fortress was a lot bigger than she remembered. Or perhaps she was smaller now. Unable to move, Alex rummaged in her bag for a tissue she didn't really need and tried to wipe away the memories of her last day here. A different time, a different person. No one will remember me. Couriers bustled in and out of the security office. Incredibly fresh-faced men and women whooshed in and out of the turnstiles, jabbing their security passes, jaws tight with their own deadlines. Was I ever that young? Alex wondered. But it was rhetorical. She was younger. She remembered the initial call-up so vividly. Scuttling out of the Ms. magazine office and hiding from colleagues in the stairwell, hand shaking so vigorously she thought she'd drop her phone.
Calling from the Times. Would you come in for a chat? Maybe meet some of the team? Talk about opportunities?
The first visit to the fortress. Deep breathing exercises on the ride over. A stiff slug from the handbag for Dutch courage. A strong mint. The arched eyebrow of the taxi driver in a smeared rearview mirror. 24 and hungry. Waiting and waiting and waiting in the security office. Visitor badge dangling. Brand new shoes tugging at newer blisters. Couriers buzzing in and out. The lazy laughter of bored desk staff. And then the phone ringing behind the desk, the clipped tone from the woman leaning over.
They want you on the red sofas. Do you know where they are?
I'm sorry, I don't. Accompanied at painful speed along the cobbles by a sighing security temp, behind the velvet rope, the inkies rushing in and out of the dirty bit on the lower floor, where execs and columnists would never deign to go. The editor's parking space as close to the main doors as a white line could ever hope to be. Once inside, Alex had drunk in the smells of the newsroom, the leather of the executive lift and the styrofoam coffee. She'd walked tall along corridors papered floor to ceiling with famous headlines. Holding her head as stiff and straight as her mother's late-night deportment lessons had taught her years before.
Just walk with the books on your head, Alexandra. It's not that hard. My God, what have I done to deserve this?
The unstoppable gush of excitement creativity, that hunger again, spilling from Alex as the smiling faces nodded from the other side of the walnut table, as polished as a bowling alley. Zeitgeist, generation, ahead of the curve, all the right phrases. And, Alex recognized looking back, her then beautiful face smiling openly, a face that would look just so above a byline. The handshake, the sealed deal, the sweats, the shits in the foyer bathrooms on the way out, barely making it. Glimpsing an oil painting of Rupert Murdoch in the reception as she walked giddily by, smiling so hard her cheekbones hurt. The burbling water feature, so 80s and ridiculous, and everything she'd ever wanted to see in the flesh. On the taxi ride home, Alex had called her mother in Spain. It had seemed like the right thing to do.
A columnist? Her mother had sniffed. It's a shame they didn't put you on the travel desk. At least then you might make the effort to come and see me.
And then Alex had phoned Matt.
Oh my fucking God. Seriously.
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 She'd squealed, kicking her legs in the back of the taxi, shoes flying as she'd slid slowly from one side to the other as the driver shook his head in the mirror, but not unkindly. That night, they'd put buttery lobster on a credit card. Delicate flutes of champagne, clinked with wild abandon, tears in their eyes. Matt had carried her home. She'd felt light as a feather. And he had made love to her so gently that she couldn't bear it. She'd sunk her nails into his flesh and dug him into her so she could be sure she was feeling everything. And his gargled voice had proposed in her ear. She'd cried,
"Yes! Oh my God, of course! Yes!"
The next day he'd woken her up with a strong coffee, kissed both her eyelids and said,
"I meant it."
If she had known how it would end, would she have taken the job? Yes. God, she was hungry then. A different time, a different person. No one will remember me.
"Do you know where to go?"
"Yes, it's fine. I used to work here."
Alex smiled at the security temp and pushed out into the grounds. As she walked along the familiar cobbles, Andy Bellamy came out of one of the side doors, shirt flapping around his big belly.
"Alex, thanks for coming in."
"No problem. It's good to see the old place."
They met awkwardly. She went for a one-cheek kiss, he for two, and they clashed mid-air.
"I thought we could grab a coffee."
The coffee shop in a chilly corner of the newspaper complex had been a thinly disguised Starbucks franchise in Alex's time. Now it appeared to be a thinly disguised Costa franchise.
"No more caramel macchiatos?" Alex asked.
"No, now it's the same old shit with a different name,"
Andy said.
"Thank our friends at the Sun. They did an expose on Starbucks wasting water and the whole thing kicked off. Anyway, take a seat."
Andy had worked on the city pages when Alex left. He hadn't been in the meeting room that last time, but he'd looked over the rim of his newsroom monitor as she'd been escorted out, flanked by security. 100 pairs of furtive eyes had looked over their monitors that day.
"So, do you miss it here?"
he asked.
"I miss the money,"
Alex laughed.
"Yeah, there's not so much of that about now, eh?"
"Hey, don't get me wrong. I'm grateful for every commission I get now. But damn, when I think about how much I got then and how little I had to write in comparison."
"What was the name of the column you did again?"
"Which one? There was the main column on Tuesday and then Losing Mum on Sunday."
"Ah, yes, of course."
Alex could see a guy in the queue that she dimly recognized and immediately worried why.
"Shame that stopped."
"Well, my mum died, so it sort of reached a natural end."
"Oh, God, I'm such a twat,"
Andy said, aghast. They both laughed.
"It's fine. It's really fine." Look, I wanted to talk to you about the Amy story you pitched, and I thought it would be easier to have a face-to-face. It's an interesting case, but I have a few misgivings. Put it this way, we couldn't make a story out of it yet.
There's definitely a lot more to be done.
Make no mistake, it's interesting, very interesting. I remember it happening. The stepdad being nicked, the mum. It's awful what happened to that family. But I'm still struggling to see how we could legitimately make a valuable article out of it now.
Alex swallowed hard. Okay, I see what you're saying, but what if new evidence was found about the person that attacked Amy? That would warrant a full feature, surely. Whoever did this is still out there. Someone capable of attacking a young girl and leaving her for dead. People don't tend to do things like that once and then retire. They tend to get worse.
Alex looked around at all the caffeinated eyes peering out from behind giant cardboard cups of coffee. She lowered her voice.
I think the key to the story is, you know, where is this guy? And what are the police doing about catching him?
Who knows?
Right, no one knows where he is, and the police aren't doing anything. It's just another cold case for them. It would only be opened up if something very similar happened.
Andy Bellamy folded his arms over his barrel tummy and cocked his head to the side.
I mean, Alex carried on, quietly. Is that okay? Should someone else's family be ripped apart before this is solved?
Okay, yeah, you've made your point, Andy said.
I'm not totally convinced, Alex, and to be frank, your last few pieces haven't really done it for me like they used to. Here's what I'll do. You bring me something with a tangible exclusive. Similar cases that hadn't been put together before. Police reopening the investigation. Some suspect they overlooked. Girl waking up and dancing the tango. Something. And we've got an interesting double-page spread. Bring me something vintage Alex Dale, and you've got yourself a full four-pager.
Andy Bellamy's words had gnawed away at her all night, and she thought of them as soon as she woke up the next morning. Parallel cases, overlooked suspects. She'd not started on anything like this. Other than rifling through all the clippings, pissing off her ex-husband and bothering a wary stepdad, she'd not done very much at all. It was a battle of willpower over fatigue to pull her running things on. But Alex knew it was the best method for clearing her head. As her trainers thumped heavily along the pavement, chest pumping and stomach gurgling, she tried to order her thoughts into some kind of plan. Retracing the police inquiry was largely pointless. They'd spoken to Bob and ruled him out. She'd spoken to Bob and ruled him out. The police had done the same to the boyfriend, the neighbours, and her teachers at school. All were incapable or elsewhere. The net needed to be widened. In 1995, there was no obvious way to pull together the social network of any one person. Apart from any help the school might have given, it would really have been up to the parents to provide a list of friends and contacts. Amy had no friends at all in 2010, but in 1995 she was still at school. She still went to youth clubs. She had had friends. Amy may not be able to maintain those connections, but her friends from 1995 would still be around, linked together by their shared school years. Alex sprinted all the way to her front door. Still panting and coated with salty sweat, she fumbled her key in the door and jogged straight over to her laptop, flipping it open and clicking into the browser window. For the first time in years, she typed www.friendsreunited.com. A quick search on Edenbridge Grammar School brought up 2,047 members. But to see them, Alex had to register or log in. After deliberately stepping away from this kind of thing ages ago, signing up felt dangerous. She added herself to Amy's school in Amy's year and filled in scant information. Alex Dale now nestled amongst Amy's classmates, right where Amy Stevenson would have sat, between the out-of-date biographies. Referring back to her transcript of the interview with Bob, Alex had jotted down some names: Jenny, Becky, and Jake. There were three Rebeccas, Harris, Lim, and Simpson,
but only one potential Jenny, Jennifer Cross. No Jake, but a Jacob Arlington. Alex's tummy fluttered. Jennifer Cross and Jacob Arlington. That had to be Jenny and Jake, surely. Everyone signed up to Friends Reunited back in the day. It had to be then. She called Bob's number, chewing the end of her pen. Hello? Hi, Bob. It's Alex Dale here. Oh. I'm really sorry to trouble you, Bob. I just had one quick question.
All right. What's the question?
Alex pictured him shuffling around, one hand in his overalls pocket. You mentioned Amy's friends, Jenny and Becky, when we spoke. I just wondered if you could remember their surnames.
God, bloody hell. I don't remember at all.
Oh, that's okay, don't worry. Perhaps if I read out the surnames I've found, you could say if they sound familiar?
I suppose so.
I'll be really quick. The Jenny I found is Jenny Cross. Does that ring any bells?
I honestly don't know.
What about Becky Harris, Becky Simpson, or Becky Lim?
Oh yeah, I do remember Lim. Becky Lim, because it's a funny name, isn't it?
Do you remember any other friends' names? Even vague memories?
No, not really, I'm afraid. Sorry, Alex.
Don't be, that's so helpful, thank you. Bob, there was one other thing, actually. Do you remember the name of Amy's boyfriend, Jake?
Yeah, I do.
Bob paused.
We used to take the mickey out of Amy because we'd found a load of little signatures she'd done, testing out a name as if they was married. We used to call her Mrs. Arlington, as a joke, you know. Jake Arlington he was. Poor sod.
That's brilliant, thanks, Bob. Alex clicked on Jacob Arlington. Generic blue avatar, no photograph. Living with Fiona in Kent, sell software. Short and practical, but then the boys' profiles were often far more functional and factual than the girls'. Jacob Arlington still lived in Kent, at least up until the last time he updated his profile, in 2007. Rebecca Lim's profile was comparatively upbeat. After Edenbridge, I went to Mid-Kent College, then uni in London. Did English Lit and now work for a PR agency in Soho. Life is good. Jennifer Cross's profile spoke of working as an estate agent in Surrey, living with her partner, expecting her first child. You must be our Jenny, Alex muttered. Opening her working document, Alex typed Jacob Jake Arlington. Under the possible suspects heading, she knew she'd need to approach him. She'd have to try to interview him, but not until she knew more about the run-up to Amy's abduction. She sent a brief message to Jennifer Cross, asking if she had been friends with Amy and would consider answering a few respectful questions. She stressed that it was for a possible article with the Times, not a tabloid. Friend or not, she was in the same year at the same school, and would surely remember who Amy was. Who Amy is, Alex corrected herself. Alex clicked on Rebecca Lim again. An English literature graduate, working in PR. Their paths could easily have crossed before. Hi, Rebecca. I hope you don't mind me contacting you like this. I'm a freelance journalist, and I recently became interested in Amy Stevenson's story. I know you were friends with Amy at school, and I don't want to upset you, but I'm writing a piece for the Times, and I'd love to know a little more about Amy. I was hoping you'd help by answering a couple of questions. I'm quite local to Edenbridge. I went to school in Tunbridge Wells, and live there again now. And I would like to assure you that I'm not trying to do anything disrespectful or sensational. I hope you can help. Kind regards, Alex Dale. alexdalewrites@gmail.com. Tell 07876-070-866. Send. Alex gave her email inbox a final refresh before switching off for the day at just gone noon. A Friends Reunited message from Rebecca Lim was waiting. Hi, Alex. I got your message through Friends Reunited.
I don't use it anymore, so the email was a bit of a bolt from the blue. I was very good friends with Amy, but what happened was a long time ago and I've tried to forget it. I don't know if you've spoken to other people from school.